I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that loves it when movies go big, though that doesn't mean just in size, scope, and volume. Sometimes the smallest film make the biggest impact. And ironically, the opposite is true too, which we just might prove this week by discussing a pair of films that many movie fans expected to be among the highest grossing productions of 2020. Well, as we all know, that dismal excuse for a year pushed the film industry to the brink of ruin. And only now are the majority of us getting to see these films, courtesy of one streaming service or another. Christopher Nolan's trek into Conundrum Country, which he titled Tenet, opened in theaters, but only for a short while. Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman 1984 opened in theaters too, though on the same day, on Christmas Day, that it was made available for streaming. Let's begin our discussion by taking a look at time. Or rather, let's look at time the way Christopher Nolan imagines it, time and how it plays into the nature of reality, which is a Nolan specialty. In 2000's Memento, which Nolan co-wrote with his brother Jonathan, a man with short-term memory loss tries to find out who murdered his wife. In 2010's Inception, a group specializes in changing people's perceptions by invading their dreams. In 2014's Interstellar, an astronaut is able to displace time in an effort to save humanity. Now we have Tenet, which, well, I'm not sure exactly what it is. Whereas Interstellar plays fast and loose with enough science to make Bill Nye's brain explode, Tenet goes a dozen theorems further. It offers up a plot involving some sort of intelligence agent, named only the protagonist, played by John David Washington, racing to find out who is threatening to destroy the world through some sort of time inversion technology. So we have bullets flying back into the guns that have fired them, cars racing in reverse down the highway, and Sir Kenneth Branagh displaying the most comical Russian accent since Yakov Smirnov. It's all fairly entertaining to watch. Yeah, no doubt that. And it all may make actual sense, but I'd need a physics professor, some PowerPoint slides, and a full semester to figure out how.
And you probably still won't get to the bottom of it, I don't think. I think this movie is like firmly locked inside the brain of the man that created it. But I've actually seen Tenet two times. I happened to see it on the big screen back in the summer, I guess it was now, at a giant and mostly empty theater in Idaho. And I really didn't like it then. And then I watched it again the other night at home with subtitles on this time, which I think it's important to point out that if you can turn on the subtitles, it's going to do you a world of good, because so much of the dialogue in this movie, not that there's any dialogue you'd necessarily want to hear, but in terms of exposition, it's just buried in music, and people constantly have like gas masks on or whatever. So it's hard to hear. But anyway, this time around, I was a bit more sympathetic to what Nolan was trying to do with Tenet. And I think, and there's some irony here, I think it helps to know where the movie ends up in order to understand all of the exposition that comes barreling at you at the very beginning. So yeah, I mean, the fact that this is a movie where it helps to know what happens in the future, you can understand the past a little bit better. But I still think this time around, I mean, it's so needlessly convoluted. It's so hilariously confusing. And it's basically 2.5 hours of people explaining concepts to each other about, oh, the grandfather paradox and this algorithm and that algorithm. And after a while, I think by the second hour, my eyes just kind of glaze over. And this screenplay, which Nolan wrote himself, I think is pretty bad. I mean, it's complex, and I think he probably wrote it with a million different flow charts up on his wall, you know, all of those things connected by like red yarn in order to figure out how all the pieces click together. But beyond that, I mean, the dialogue in this is just laughable. I mean, there's a moment where at the very beginning, he says, oh, what is this going to be, World War III? And one of the scientists says, no, something worse. And then there's another moment where he says, oh, all of civilization is going to be destroyed. And the character played by Elizabeth Debicki says, and that includes my son. And it's like, yeah, no kidding, lady. Of course it is. He said everybody. And I mean, that Elizabeth Debicki character is, a lot of critics have written about this already, but she is just done dirty by this movie, I think. And then at the end, he goes for emotion between these two characters played by John David Washington and Robert Pattinson, who are both pretty good under the circumstances, I think. And there's just no reason for us to care about these people at all. And you're just thinking, did I miss like scenes where they were developing a relationship here? So, yeah, I think that and we can talk about, you know, the technical side of this movie, because this movie, Tenet, is all technical. And I think all of that is just it's a grade level. But I do think that this movie is kind of at it's hollow at its core. And so, yeah, two times through, I understand it a little better now. Could I pass a test on the details? Absolutely not.
I agree completely with everything that you said, Nathan. And so that doesn't always happen, but it does sometimes happen. And I always focus in on the performances, and that is part of the difficulty here, because we do have two good performances the way that I viewed this. And John David Washington, not as notable as he was in BlacKkKlansman, but good. And Robert Pattinson, I continue to be amazed by him and Kristen Stewart. How did these people get stuck in that like
Twilight series?
Right. And then we found out subsequently that they're both extremely talented. And I really like what he does here. The problem is the pacing was just so strange, because at different points, Nathan, as you point out, there are these dialogues between people, and it's sort of slow, but yet it's still not slow enough for the regular non-scientific human brain to understand what's going on. So the pacing's really odd. And then there are these spectacular scenes of, you know, attack and, you know, so forth and so on. And then some things happen that seem to belie the principles on which this is based. So we are dealing with this inversion theory where things sort of happen in reverse, but they only happen partially in reverse. So sometimes you see cars backing up and people backing up and bullets backing up. But then when you're in the same time period, or what seems to be the same time period, people are going forward and you're sort of like, wait a minute, is everything happening? Is it happening only to some people and so forth? I think if people want to get a good sense of what this film is like, you should read Anthony Lane's review in The New Yorker, because he just decides to go full bore
stand-up comedy.
Right, yeah. And stand-up comedy approach to dealing with this. And I don't even think we need to talk about some of the other performances like Kenneth Branagh or Elizabeth Debicki, because also two excellent superior actors, but why they're stuck in here, it's almost they got stuck in a time warp.
Elizabeth Debicki, I mean, she's playing basically the same role she played in that miniseries The Night Manager. It's basically the same character.
And well, she's a punching bag in this movie, essentially. Yeah. And she's there just to have a son that she can worry about. I mean, that is her function in this story.
The relationship between her and the John David Washington, the protagonist, doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I mean, are we supposed to believe that there's some sort of emotional tie between these two? It just doesn't make any sense. One thing you mentioned, Nathan, that I think we got to point out is the music for this movie was horrible. I mean, not only was it overwrought, it was too loud. So much of the dialogue was lost, as you pointed out, because they were speaking in masks. It's almost like, what was it, the Dark Knight Rises, which with the Tom Hardy character playing Bane wearing a mask. I think ultimately Tenet is like something that was written by that kid in high school class who was really, really smart, but was trying desperately to show you how smart he is. And so he comes up with something that is really clever, but no one understands it. He does, but no one else does. And you have to ask yourself, in a blockbuster film, is that really what you want?
Well, and there's this running thing. And by the way, the music that you mentioned is by Ludwig Göransson, who won an Oscar for Black Panther. It kind of has some cool like motifs of instruments running backwards. And it's a little better than you think, but overwrought. Absolutely. I agree with you. There's this running thing that I keep seeing in reviews of Tenet, this line of dialogue that people keep latching onto, where there's a character who says, "Don't think about it, just feel it," which is an interesting idea in theory. And you know, I don't mind a movie that I don't understand. I mean, I love David Lynch, for God's sake. But this movie doesn't have any feeling in it. And I think that's part of the problem, is that if you did have a human element here, because he tries to put a human element in here and it doesn't work. I think if you had something like that, or if the spectacle carried it, and in some stretches of the movie, there is that big car chase in the middle that I do think is pretty exciting, even though I don't quite understand it. I just wish that, yeah, there was something here at the center so that I could just not think about it and feel it. But yeah, by the end, and there's this big military siege at the end where half of them are going forward and half of them are going backward, which sounds really cool in theory. But like I said, I just, by that point, I'm kind of deadened. All of my senses are overloaded and I just kind of give up a little bit.
I have to give a shout out here to my colleague, Eric Aver, in the physics, who is a physics professor. And this is one time that I wish we weren't in COVID time, so Dan and I had been able to go see this movie with him, because
he could have explained everything.
Yes, he probably could have explained it all to
us.
And
if he couldn't have, then we would have known. Okay, yes, exactly. Nolan, you went way, way, way too far. At any rate, we were talking about Christopher Nolan's movie Tenet. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access this podcast of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Patty Jenkins's Wonder Woman 1984. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discuss Christopher Nolan's puzzle of a film, Tenet. Let's now move to something slightly more pedestrian, if no less fantastic, Wonder Woman 1984. In the race to see which of the two main comic book brands, Marvel and DC Comics, would succeed in making the most popular blockbusters, Marvel has had the edge, by far. DC made its biggest splash in 2017 with Wonder Woman, directed by Patty Jenkins and starring Israeli actress Gal Gadot. So hopes were high in early 2020 when dates were set for the film's sequel, Wonder Woman 1984, with both Jenkins and Gadot reprising their roles. Living in Washington, D.C., where she exists a la Clark Kent, Wonder Woman, a.k.a. Diana Prince, works in the Smithsonian Institution while protecting citizens from harm in her spare moments. When a priceless object called the Dream Stone falls into the hands of her colleague, Barbara, played by Kristen Wiig, a would-be oil magnate named Maxwell Lord, played by Pedro Pascal of the Mandalorian series, seeks it out. Seems it has the power of making all wishes come true. Somehow, this ends up giving Barbara Wonder Woman-like superpowers. It resurrects Diana's late love, Steve Trevor, played again by Chris Pine, and it puts Pascal's Maxwell Lord in the position of destroying all humanity, which, of course, is a fate that Wonder Woman labors to avoid. At least a half hour or more too long, full of sequences that go nowhere in terms of plot, and so in need of editing that it's not even half as energetic as its predecessor, Wonder Woman 1984 does little to buoy DC Comics' attempt to reach even a Marvel level of success.
I have to agree totally with everything that you said. So this is the consensus day, I guess, on Movies 101, where people are agreeing with one another. And unfortunately, I wish that I could agree about something that was really inspiring and entertaining, but this is not that movie. Hopefully, most people have already seen it, and so that you can draw your own conclusions, because it was the Christmas Day blockbuster, the family movie of the holiday season. And I was just so disappointed about everything in this film. I mean, at one point I turned to Dan and I said, what year is this? And he said, hello, it's titled Wonder Woman 1984. So, but it that didn't even feel authentic to me, the way that it was set. And I am sorry, I thought Gal Gadot was amazing in the first one. And I don't know, it's almost as though they woke her up from sleep and she was like groggy throughout the entire film because there was no energy. There was sort of no enthusiasm that she generated at any point, as far as I was concerned. And Kristen Wiig, of course, we love her from Saturday Night Live. We love her from Bridesmaids. She has a new comedy coming out in a couple of months, but she, you know, was doing her best, but her character was not really realistic in any way. Not that,
and it was a cliche.
Yeah, it was. That was my problem. It was the ultimate cliche performance, and she did what she could. The only part of this film that I liked was the first 10 minutes when it was sort of a flashback to Wonder Woman's childhood. And I liked that part of it. And we got to see Connie Nielsen. We got to see Robin Wright. And we had a little girl playing Wonder Woman. So she was Wonder Girl. And that was a nice substitute for Gal Gadot because the little girl brought much more energy to what was happening here. Chris Pine was fine, but no, this was just such a huge miss and just such a huge disappointment for those of us who are Wonder Woman fans. You know, I had my Wonder Woman sneakers on and I was like ready to go here. And no, it just fell flat.
Yeah. Well, and I want to talk about Kristen Wiig because, I mean, in the tradition of comic book movie sequels, you have more than one main villain here. And I have to admit, I liked the original Wonder Woman. I don't remember who the main villain was because the villain didn't leave an impression in that first movie. It was mostly about the interplay between Diana Prince and the world at large, but also Diana Prince and Steve Trevor. And so now we have two villains for the price of one this time around. You have Kristen Wiig as Barbara Minerva and Pedro Pascal as Maxwell Lord. And I think you needed one or the other, or amp both of them up, or have them come together at some point, because those two plot lines never converge. It's like they had two separate scripts and then just kind of jammed them together. And not only that, but Kristen Wiig's, I mean, you're right. She's the scientist with glasses who, you know, gets the makeover overnight and then becomes, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman, but without any of the camp value to that. And I was also thinking about Maxwell Lord because I think Pedro Pascal has the right energy for this character. I think he's the best thing in the movie. And he's clearly like a Trumpian kind of figure, this guy who's lost everything and is trying desperately to get attention so that he can, you know, build his business empire back up again. And it's this monkey's paw scenario, right, where he gets this wishing stone and he can make anything come true, but at a price. And I kept thinking about how much fun you could have with that premise. It's such a basic premise and you could do anything with it. And it's indicative of this entire movie is that they don't do anything with it. Like, I kept thinking, at one point he goes to Cairo and he's trying to get the oil reserves. He's talking with this oil magnate in Egypt. And I'm thinking, why does he need to go to Cairo to get oil? He can literally manifest anything in the world for his own benefit. This is totally unnecessary. And all of that stuff doesn't rear its head until like the very end of the movie, when we see all of these people having their contradictory wishes come true all at once. And we see the mayhem that causes, but it's a 5-minute blip. This, you're right. This is a total missed opportunity. And I'm looking at the posters of Wonder Woman 1984. They're all day glow and psychedelic. None of that's in this movie. It's like, it's so drab and flat. Yeah. And there are like no fun 80s musical cues. I don't understand why they wanted to set it in the 80s, other than you get like some intrigue with some Middle Eastern tensions and a character who kind of looks like Ronald Reagan, you know, a little bit. Yeah. But yeah, I agree with you that Wonder Woman 84 is a total bust, not just because there was potential here, but because they took probably the best DC film and then made one of the worst DC films with the same people.
So let's talk a little bit about the performances, because I don't understand how Gal Gadot could be Wonder Woman in the original film and then just, phone in this performance. So do you think it's due to the script? Is it directing? Is it the fact that she was good when there was more focus on the relationship with Chris Pine, which there is some of that here too.
And let me jump in here and just say, I think it's the problem with the whole film. I mean, everything that was good about the first film is totally wasted here. Gal Gadot was very good in the first movie. She's not good here. But think about the music of the first movie. It was done by Rupert Gregson-Williams. And was there anything more stirring in 2017 than those shots of Wonder Woman with that one theme, ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum? And that's totally wasted in this film because Hans Zimmer takes over. And it's like, well, I'm Hans Zimmer. I can't use the good music from the other movie. I have to move my own stupid music. And it's just forgettable. I don't know that this movie could have been saved in any way, shape, or form, but editing might have helped.
I have a theory about the Gal Gadot performance because I think that part of the appeal of the original one was that you have Wonder Woman as this kind of fish out of water. It's the same appeal that we've seen in the Captain America movies and the Thor movies, where you have these larger than life, you know, mythical figures suddenly dropped into a totally different world in a totally different era. And the comedy comes from watching them try and figure out basic everyday human things. And so I think Gal Gadot is good at playing that kind of, you know, wide-eyed sort of wonder. Here, Diana Prince has lived long enough in the world. She's figured out how society works. And so now she's just like an 80s businesswoman type. And I mean, I think as an actress, she probably doesn't have the greatest range imaginable. But here she's supposed to sell a lot of more supposedly nuanced emotions than in the first one, and it doesn't come off. Also, the whole thing with Steve Trevor is really weird because he comes back and he inhabits someone else's body.
Right.
The movie never stops to wonder, like, who was this guy? Like, yeah, you see him at the very end. And I kept thinking about this. Think about how much fun you could have with that idea.
Right.
Like, what if she's out with Steve Trevor and some guy stops and goes, hey, it's Rick or whatever, and they have to play it off.
Yeah, and I think that so here the fish out of water character, of course, is played by Steve Trevor, by Chris Pine.
Right.
And Gal Gadot has to explain all these things to him, but it's so overly simplistic and ridiculous.
And his exit in the movie is a whimper. It's not even a sob.
Yeah. It's just off screen.
Oh, here goes Steve. Oh, it's what a waste.
Yeah. So I guess we have three big thumbs down on this one.
Yeah. And that was Wonder Woman 1984. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbindemer, Pat Truthart, and I discussed Christopher Nolan's cryptic study, Tenet. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you too, our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. Until then, remember these words from the late, great Kurt Vonnegut in his masterpiece novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. It is just an illusion here on Earth that one moment follows another one, like beads on a string, and that once a moment is gone, it is gone forever. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.